Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This week we're considering the stiff debate between WESPAC, the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, which has asked President Trump to reconsider the restrictions on fishing in the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument, and the environmental groups, which supported the regulations expanded last fall by the Obama administration. We heard from WESPAC yesterday. Today, Paul Achitoff of the national nonprofit environmental law firm Earth Justice joins us. Welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Beth Ann.
At its base, is this debate about whether the Marine National Monument is really a good idea? Is that really what we're talking about?
Well, I suppose from WESPAC's standpoint, they apparently believe it's not a good idea. So, that's their perspective. They're at the time of the decision to expand it, there was a great deal of material and evidence that had been generated demonstrating that it was a good idea. There was a substantial body of evidence put together in a report that was put together by leading scientists and included sign-on from 1,500 other scientists that described in detail the biological and cultural evidence for expanding Papahanaumokuakea. So, but from WESPAC's standpoint, if they can't do whatever they want, fish wherever they want, it's not a good idea. I disagree.
So then looking at the idea of why it needs to be protected in this way, which also seems to be part of the argument against it, how would you say that we all need to look at this if we were to look at it through your eyes?
The way that I look at it and the way that the scientists who have looked at it think is that we are talking about a unique resource that has an incredible array of both biological and cultural resources that need to be preserved. And commercial exploitation in that particular area is contrary to the larger public interest in having these resources preserved for future generations. We're talking about thousands of species, including many endangered species. I've worked for many years on trying to protect, for example, endangered sea turtles, albatross, monk seals, all of which are caught in the longline fishery. Sharks are another example. Looking at the logbook reports from the longline fishery from January to December 2014, I note that just in the EEZ, the exclusive economic zone out to which the monument was expanded last year, in that area, the longliners caught one blue shark for every two big eye that they caught. Now, if you think about that, that's a lot of bycatch of sharks to catch some big eye that can be caught somewhere else. Now, so from that perspective, there's other forms of commercial exploitation too. It's not just the longliners that are being kept out of that area. We're talking about deep sea mining, which is another potential threat to these resources. These areas need to be protected, and I think that there is a global awareness of this. This is not the only monument. It just happens to be a big one.
Are the monuments in general feeling a threat now that wasn't present even 6 months ago?
Well, certainly we have an administration that is extraordinarily anti-environmental in its ideology. And I think anything is possible from this administration in terms of trying to roll back protections that have been put in place previously, not simply by President Obama, but, the monument was actually designated by President George W. Bush. So it doesn't really matter who put these in place. I think we can see the Trump administration trying to roll back any and all protections as they have been, doing on an almost daily basis.
Paul, what about threats external to the Oval Office? Other groups may be challenging whether these Marine National Monuments should even exist.
There is a lawsuit that was filed recently by Pacific Legal Foundation, which is a conservative group that brings litigation to challenge the validity of the designation of a National Marine Monument off the East Coast. They're arguing that the Antiquities Act, which is the basis for designating national monuments, doesn't allow the designation of marine areas. Earth Justice will be intervening in that suit and making its arguments, and ultimately the judge will decide. But something like that has the potential to affect our monument as well.
Meanwhile, there is a lot of conversation still here about what happens with Papahānaumokuakea and whether there will be any intervention to allow greater fishing there. We heard from Westpac yesterday saying, look, these are pelagic fish. We have to go off, and they're going all over the place. They'll be coming through here. Why shouldn't we stay here? How do you answer them when they're talking about having to run after fish to be able to get their quota, which they seem to get earlier and earlier?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. They have no trouble reaching their quota. Last year, they met it, if I'm not mistaken, by July of 2016. That's an annual quota. So clearly, they can meet their quota. And when they met their quota last year, they simply bought up the quotas of Western Pacific Islands and used their quotas. So they have no trouble finding fish. And as they point out, those fish go all over the Pacific. Yes, they do. And in recent years, Westpac has been catching only about 5% of its catch. The longliners, I should say, have been catching only about 5% of their catch within the area that is now off limits as a result of the expansion. So all they need to do is continue fishing where they have found 95% of their catch previously.
The point that American fisheries are much more regulated and observed than are those from other nations is also a point that Westpac has been making in saying that, look, we're buying fish from other nations who sometimes come into our waters illegally, and we buy most of them from it. And if our guys were able to go out there and fish, well, we would be decreasing how much we're bringing in illegally. Does that hold any weight as far as you're concerned, that argument?
Well, first of all, I see no evidence that there's any meaningful amount of fish that's being imported from foreign fisheries that are fishing illegally, which I assume to mean fishing within the exclusive economic zone. If there is such fish, I think it's a very small amount. And I think in any event, it's really irrelevant because, as I pointed out, the longliners have a quota. They will meet their quota. And what the other fisheries do, therefore, really does not affect the longliners' ability to catch what our laws allow them to catch. This whole argument that foreign fisheries are somehow at an advantage is irrelevant if you take into account the fact that the longliners are going to be able to catch every fish that they're legally entitled to catch and sell it to whoever will buy it.
Should consumers know exactly where their fish comes from?
I think it's good for consumers to know where their food comes from, whether it's fish or any other kind of food, absolutely, for any number of reasons.
As now this has been touched off again because of the letter that was sent earlier this month in which Westpac is arguing that, well, Earth Justice was lobbying, and you say, no, it's not lobbying when you send a letter to the president. How would you answer them for that?
Earth Justice was lobbying or
Westpac?
Yeah.
That they were lobbying. In fact, that you have said that they were lobbying.
Right. Well, the issue of the extent to which or if Westpac is unlawfully – there's no question that they lobby. I mean, when you send a letter to the president, you're lobbying. But the question of whether it is unlawful lobbying, you know, Westpac has its arguments, and I'm just looking at the law I have in front of me, for example, 50 CFR 600.227, lobbying. This is a federal law. Council members, meaning Westpac, council members, employees, and contractors must comply with the requirements of 31 U.S.C. 1352 and Department of Commerce implementing regulations published at 15 CFR Part 28, quote, new restrictions on lobbying. These provisions generally prohibit the use of federal funds for lobbying the executive or legislative branches of the federal government in connection with the award meaning the receipt of federal funds, which is to say Westpac's budget. So, you know, Westpac has been saying, well, we're only lobbying the executive branch, and so these lobbying rules don't apply to us. That's not what I'm seeing in this law, you know, and there are others. You know, if I look at 2 CFR Part 230, Appendix B, Section 25D, I see a whole section that provides that costs incurred in attempting to improperly influence either directly or indirectly an employee or officer of the executive branch of the federal government to give consideration or to act regarding a sponsored agreement or a regulatory matter are unallowable.
So, Paul, I mean, having heard some of those things in your read of it, as with many things, we can read different things and see them differently. What will it take to get a definitive read on any of this, and where do we go from here? And we've got to be out in about 30 seconds.
Well, Earth Justice and a number of other groups signed on to a letter that was sent to our congressional delegation last week asking for an investigation into these types of practices, which have been going on for a long time. And we want an investigation of whether this is, in fact, lawful.
So we're going to wait and see if we get that investigation. I want to thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me, Beth Ann.
Paul Achitoff is the managing attorney for the Mid-Pacific Office of Earth Justice. It's the local affiliate of the national nonprofit environmental law firm. Earth Justice opposes reversing the restrictions on commercial fishing within the Papahanaumokuakea National Marine Monument. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, honoring the generations of families that have kept Hawaiian music alive. But first, your backyard quiz.
O Maui, o Kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
Since our next story deals with the Hawaiian Music Hall of Fame, today's backyard quiz is looking at that same body, specifically at one of its inductees. We're thinking about a superstar of Hawaiian music, a charter member of the Hawaiian Music Hall of Fame. He was born in 1902, the last of 21 children of a Honolulu family that recognized his talent when he was very young. He started playing the ukulele before he was three and had switched to the steel guitar before he reached his teens. He found his way to the mainland as a stowaway aboard the Matsonia and became a star performer in Los Angeles nightclubs before he was 20. By 1924, he was leading a trio in Los Angeles where audiences had fallen in love with Hawaiian music. His distinctive sound on steel guitar remains influential today and has inspired generations of country and blues musicians. This morning, we're looking for the name of this musical pioneer. And if you know him, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Mm-hmm. Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center. Company Hervé Kubi combines acrobatics, dance, modern dance, and ballet in its Maui debut performance, 7:30 p.m. this Thursday at Castle Theater, mauiarts.org.
Every generation of Hawaiian musicians builds on the legacy of those who have gone before, and much of that legacy is contained within families. Auntie Genoa Keawe was one of the Hall of Fame's original inductees. You couldn't imagine it without her. And this year's upcoming ceremony honors her ohana. Ku'u'ipo Kumukahi is a member of the Hawaiian Music Hall of Fame Advisory Board. She's with us in our studio. And that's a pretty fair assessment, isn't it, Ku'u'ipo, about the whole family nature of Hawaiian music?
Aloha mai. Yes, Hawaiian music has been very prevalent amongst Hawaiian families. It's actually the thread that kept Hawaiian families intact. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good social gatherings, and sometimes non-family members came along and just sang, you know, mm-hmm. If you take a look at some of these songs in history, if you went to any Hawaiian home across the islands, everybody sang the same song. Mm-hmm. If it was an honor to Queen Liliuokalani, or if it was just kind of a fun song that talked about fun pastimes. Mm-hmm. Everybody was very much related to the songs in different ways, but that kept everybody, you know, connected. So if Grandma sang the Holo Holo Ka'a, or she sang Oma Kalapua,
uh-huh.
Her children would know that, the grandchildren would know that, and now after Grandma has passed, we kept singing these songs so that the next generation will hear it. So it's Hawaiian music, or the mele. You know, the mele holds all of the information
right.
of Hawaiian. And if you, I say this all the time, if you want to know anything about who we are, where we come from, and our history, look to the music.
It's history contained in song.
Absolutely. And that's what Hawaiians did in the past. They committed their information to poetry, mm-hmm. creating chants, then extending it to hula. Further into the future, when all the instruments get introduced to Hawaii, then the melodic line comes in through missionaries and the hymns. And then later on with guitars and, you know, the invention of the steel guitar, the music still continues to hold the message because we're still singing songs that are 100 years old. Songs written by our royalty. We're still doing it today in the 21st century because it has information in there. And it keeps us connected to our past.
And you know, from an exterior sort of Western music approach, you might think of songs and dances as entertainment, not so much as repositories of information, of history.
Correct.
You know, the European notion is that history should be between the covers of a book. not in a melee that takes 8 hours.
Correct. So you can see the vast difference.
Yeah.
For our people, you know, you have to know that there were no written apparatuses. We didn't have a written language. We had petroglyphs. Yeah. So everything had to be committed somewhere. So mm-hmm. a lot of it was through poetry. And in 2007, when the Hawaiian Music Hall of Fame created the CD Nalani Eha, looking at those songs, just the 10 songs that were recorded, we looked at that as such a piece of beyond just art, but a real testament to leadership. So we ended up concluding saying that, you know, Hawaiian music, or the royalty and their leadership skills, one was of great leadership if they could compose.
Mm-hmm.
That was a true Hawaiian leadership skill. And, you know, we tried to figure out, you know, how many different sovereigns around the world during the 18th, 19th century did this kind of work
yeah.
for their people. And we couldn't come up with anybody. So what is unique about our history is that we keep it alive through voice. And, you know, of course, singing takes breath,
mm-hmm.
much like how they say, you know, the breath of life comes
right.
through aloha and the ha. Not necessarily, that's not connected to aloha, but, you know, through aloha, the ha, you have to, that all of this is living. So when you're alive and you're singing these mele, you're making connections not only to your families, but you start making connections to land, people, the elements, just everything that surrounds you. And it's that, and that is truly a Hawaiian trait, you know, and it makes us very unique in that sense.
Yeah, because if you contrast it with what you know, just for purposes of simplicity, you would call sort of a European approach of separating music and dance away from history, mm-hmm. this, what you're describing, coming through the breath and having history be, it's integral to not just to the arts of a people, but to the physical body of a people.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? The act of breathing is the act of celebrating your history and keeping information alive for next generations.
Correct. And, you know, when I talk about breathing, it's, you really have to breathe what those words are saying. Mm-hmm. So, you know, now we get to the more technical part of maybe a singer or a chanter. You can have a body of words that you just recite, but yeah. you can have a body of words that you breathe those words. When, in my mana'o, my thought is, when you breathe that, now people will begin to breathe with you. So it's a whole nother level of consciousness and spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it's almost like you forget that your feet are on the ground, yet they're there and grounded, but you somehow are lifted in this spirituality to let people breathe what you're feeling and what you're knowing. That is truly, it's not even art. It's
life.
It's life. It's like a whole different religion. You know?
Well, and as you know, as a singer, when you sing with people, to sing with people is to breathe with people.
That's right. Exactly. Right? And so we keep breathing this history, this information. And my hope is that in my lifetime, I will be able to at least touch 10 to 12 people to say, this is what you carry on.
Yeah.
This is what has to happen so that Hawaii continues to live and, you know, not just be concrete. There's beyond the concretes and beyond, you know, buildings and things. There's a true bed of beauty that lies beneath all of this what they call construction and business.
Well, that's peripheral to life, you
right.
know. That comes and goes. But
true.
the tradition you're describing worked for you as becoming a singer. And it's something there's no reason to believe it isn't going to be carried on, right?
I'm hoping, you know, with different trends throughout the world, you know, cell phones, internet, you know, those just become complacent for the information. It's just you can read it and then just move on, right? Like the book idea.
But these are things we always come back to.
Well,
family,
yeah.
breathing,
and
life,
we hope that the
song.
Family can stick together. And we you know, just off the cuff, I can see that, you know, the Hawaiian families are not as intact as they have been, we have been in the past. I mean, surely you don't have families with 14, 15 kids anymore. You know, like my mother comes from a family of 14 children, you know, so you don't see that. Economically, it's not affordable.
Yeah.
You see more economically, people are disappearing. The local people are disappearing from Hawaii. And so the music kind of is brittle.
You know, but I get a feeling it's going to survive.
I do too, and with programs such as this, more people know the better.
Exactly.
You know, I'm currently at the Hyatt Regency Waikiki as their manager of Hawaiian culture and community relations, and I'm really happy that they're embracing that Hawaiian needs to permeate throughout their property, and along with that, the first part of that is the song. There's songs for where we're at. And from there, I'm able to take it, you know, to another level, to bring them to these songs and to know.
I think there's every reason to be optimistic.
Yes.
Thanks so much for coming.
No, a pleasure.
Kuipo Kumukahi is a member of the Hawaiian Music Hall of Fame Advisory Board, which will honor the Keawe Ohana and 2001 inductee Auntie Genoa Keawe this Saturday evening in the Cole Ballroom of the Hyatt Regency Waikiki.
Deep concerns over law enforcement brought many bills to the legislature to accelerate reform, but as of Friday's deadline, only a few of the measures are still alive, and some might say the overall effort is tepid at best. CivilBeat.org's Nick Gruby has today's reality check. Hi there.
Hi, Bethann. Thanks for having me.
Now, in the last few years, both in and out of Hawaii, we've experienced more awareness of the reasons for greater accountability of law enforcement, but it seems that it's still a hard sell in Hawaii. What did you find?
Yeah, well, I mean, for several years, Hawaii lawmakers have discussed police reform here, not only in light of all of the stuff that we've been seeing going on the mainland, particularly with the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, but also here with our police chief and our police department under investigation for public corruption and abuse of power, in addition to just general misconduct in which officers had been getting arrested, but they're just, for whatever reason, despite all of that news, there hasn't been an appetite to sort of increase accountability or even transparency.
So we've got the sensitivity to the issues, but we don't necessarily have remedies of a great nature moving through the legislature. There still are some bills alive. Which ones are they?
Yeah, there are a handful of bills. One that would sort of increase would make it easier for victims of domestic violence at the hands of police officers to report those crimes and to those officers' superiors and possibly result in an administrative investigation against them. And also another that would increase transparency surrounding suspended police officers, where if an officer is suspended twice in 5 years, we can know their name. Currently, State law doesn't allow us to know who those officers are due to a law that was passed by the police union back in 1995.
Nick, those are two ones that are still alive, but the police cam, the body cam bill, that went down, didn't it?
It did, and I think that was a little bit surprising to a lot of folks here, particularly because a similar bill, almost an identical bill, had made it all the way through to conference committee during last year's legislative session. This year, there just didn't seem to be that same push or interest in getting it to move forward. That said, the county police departments themselves are working on implementing their own rules and programs for body cameras. It's just without a statewide law, each county could have its own set of rules governing when the cameras are turned on and when the footage should be released to the public.
And maybe that's part of the exchange that we're seeing, that counties are taking over more, and whether that will continue on, we will wait and see. But thanks very much. We will talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Every day we bring you a reality check from CivilBeat.org. Today, featuring reporter Nick Gruby.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
Hawaii's long battle against invasives could be getting huge help from a measure still alive in the legislature. HB 606 would allow county invasive control authorities to have access to private land to rein in or eradicate pests. It's set for a vote tomorrow. Springer Kay, the manager of the Big Island Invasive Species Committee, calls it a game changer. We talked earlier this morning first about why there seems to be so little opposition to a bill giving county officials combating invasives the authority to do it on private land.
Well, you know, you're right. There's been very little opposition for the most part. We have overwhelming support. Even the mayors and council members from Maui and the Big Island have been testifying. And among those who do oppose it, the reasons are, you know, sort of ideological rather than practical or personal. These are people who maybe mistrust government generally, but they don't actually mind when it comes down to having problematic pest species like little fire ants removed from their property, sometimes for free, by polite, well-trained project staff. So, you know, a lot of these very high-profile invasive species issues that have come up over the last few years have really woken people up to just how serious an invasive pest can be. You have Albizia during Tropical Storm Estelle. You have little fire ants spreading now to Maui and to Oahu. And really frightening diseases like the one striking the ohia trees, rapid ohia death, and rat lungworm disease. So people are very much woken up, and the legislature is paying attention.
If the state already has this authority, why do the counties also need it?
Right. So the Big Island Invasive Species Committee is not part of the county, but we're county-based. We contact 400 to 500 landowners every year to request access to control some of the highest risk invasive species threats in our community. So these are things that are very high priorities here, like Albizia or cooking frogs, but because they're widespread here, they may not raise to the level of a state priority. The Department of Agriculture may not be willing to assert its authority to respond. At the county level, when one of these pests arrives at a new neighborhood, it is a priority. And if your community is willing to get together and fight this pest, but maybe you have one landowner who's either not interested or refusing access, that creates a real problem and can affect the entire neighborhood in a negative way.
So the bottom line really is that the counties and communities are closer to where the problems are, and therefore it's easier for them to be able to solve it if they've got this kind of authority, right?
That's right. And the Department of Agriculture is stretched thin, particularly on the neighbor islands. They simply don't have the capacity to go out and respond to every new threat. And so essentially deputizing the counties to do a lot of this work would be beneficial for the state as well as the local residents.
There was a companion bill to HB 606 in the Senate. That one, SB 637, didn't cross over, and yet, you know, the language was pretty much identical. Why do you think the House bill moved and the Senate bill didn't?
Just a really simple thing. The House Bill 606 moved ahead and crossed over, so 637 was no longer necessary.
Yeah, but why do you think that the House bill was able to move faster than the Senate bill?
That's unusual. You know, in the past, the Senate has tended to be more supportive of conservation and invasive species bills. So I think I'm optimistic that we're seeing a lot stronger commitment among our representatives to move these bills along.
At this point, if you had to list priorities for what invasives you really want to tackle first, I mean, clearly we've been hearing lots about the little fire ant, but there are others. What's on your list, especially for the Big Island?
Oh, well, unfortunately, we have our share. So right now, rat lungworm disease, which is spread by invasive bugs and snails, is a really high priority. There's a bill, Senate Bill 272, to fund a study here at the University of Hawaii at Hilo to really get a handle on just how serious this disease is and how it's being spread. So rat lungworm disease is a big one. The other one is rapid ohia death, again, a pathogen that is very strongly affecting our ohia trees, the most dominant tree in our watershed. So those are the two big ones for this year.
Rat lungworm disease and the ohia trees, clearly the little fire ant, the cookie frog. How about the coffee berry borer?
Oh, thanks for reminding me. Yes. That obviously has been a devastating disease for the Kona coffee industry, and Representative Nicole Lowen has been wonderful in working with that industry and with her colleagues at the legislature to bring subsidies to continue to apply the biocontrol And it has been very effective in reducing the damage that that pest causes.
And one last question, Springer. How dependent are the three bills that we just talked about, the SB 272, HB 481, and HB 186? How dependent are they on the bill that we started to talk about, which is HB 606, that would allow the county authorities to walk into somebody's private land to be able to control a pest?
That's a great question. So HB 606 is one that I think is foundational. It is a game changer. Getting onto people's lands, and frequently, again, this is addressing landowners that are living far away. They're not necessarily saying no. They're just not explicitly saying, yes, you can come on my property. So being able to get into the site to see how far these diseases have spread, how much problems they're causing, and when it's possible to eradicate the pest or the vector of the disease, just being able to get there is the key.
And would circumvent someone who is just maybe indecisive or hasn't bothered to answer when you've asked, can we come on your property to do this?
That's absolutely right.
All right. Well, we don't have long to wait to see how this moves. It's up for a vote tomorrow. Thanks very much for the time today.
Thank you.
Springer Kay is the project manager of the Hilo-based Big Island Invasive Species Committee. The group focuses on efforts helping communities manage their backyard invasives. More than 1,000 Big Island residents have attended a volunteer workday or hands-on training session hosted by the committee, and that's more than one out of every 200 residents on the island. HB 606 is scheduled for a vote tomorrow at the legislature.
Aloha, I'm Carl Meyer from the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's backyard quiz, we remembered a pioneering Hawaiian musician who became a worldwide ambassador of the steel guitar. He was a superstar in popular music in the 1920s and 30s, whose distinctive sounds had a huge influence far from his island home in both country and blues music. His trio was hired to demonstrate the first electric steel guitars when amplified instruments were seen as radical new inventions. He played popular standards as well as Hawaiian songs. In 2012, his recording of George Gershwin's Fascinating Rhythm was added to the Library of Congress National Recording Registry. That's a list of recordings that are, quote, culturally, historically, or aesthetically important and or inform and reflect life in the United States. His name was Saul Ho'opi'i, and he is today's answer. Nobody got that, so we'll hang on to our prize, but at least you know a little bit more today. That's the quiz. If you've got one, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra's Ocean Dreams, with music by Mendelssohn and Zemlinsky. Joanne Folletta conducts Saturday night and Sunday afternoon at the Blaisdell. HISymphony.org.
The Disney musical, based on an animated film, has almost become a theatrical genre unto itself. With all the guaranteed crowd-pleasing stories and catchy songs we've come to associate with shows like The Lion King and Aladdin. Director Claire Fallon is presently in rehearsals for an all-girl production of Aladdin Jr. at the Priory, and she's with us now. It's Aladdin Jr., so that's this is a slightly, licensed for schools version of the,
exactly.
the show?
Exactly, yeah, because the main one is still on Broadway.
Right.
So this is a shortened version.
Uh-huh.
It's only about an hour, even a little bit less.
Uh-huh.
So it's perfect to bring little ones that even can't sit through a movie. They get really
right, an hour and a half is asking a lot of
yeah.
little ones.
yeah,
hour's just about right.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
But it's got the songs, it's got the theme, it's got the same thing you would get from the Broadway show.
Exactly. A Whole New World, Friend Like Me. And then there's even a couple of new ones that Jafar sings.
Uh-huh.
And our Jafar Katie chorus, she really rocks it.
So line up the characters for me. Jafar is who?
Okay, Jafar is the evil villain who takes things really personally.
Uh-huh.
And he kind of goes back and forth like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Uh-huh.
And if something happens to him, he's like, ah, you know, and he gets really upset. Kind of like somebody else that is in our political world, but... and it's interesting to actually see that. And then we've also got Aladdin, who we have played by a female, but it's still going to be male.
Right.
And then we have Jasmine, Princess Jasmine, who mm-hmm. Aladdin wants to marry and be someone. He thinks he has to be someone else mm-hmm. in order to win her over. And that's one of the main themes of the show.
Well, because he's from the lower classes,
yeah.
right?
He's a street rat.
Yeah.
And so if he can just be himself at the end, mm-hmm. then he gets to wed the princess and all the riches.
But it helps to have a genie.
Exactly. So that's where our production is a little bit different. Our genie, we've turned into a female character. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone is a female, but they're playing male roles.
Right.
But our genie is a female genie,
mm-hmm.
which really changes a lot to have this like mystical, powerful being female. Because she has the power over everyone and as can change the course of events. And anyone who controls the genie controls the world pretty much. Like
yeah,
you can do anything
yeah.
you want with your wishes.
Well, it's nice to move the power figure away from
right.
always having to be male, right?
Yeah, yeah. And we do that a lot in our productions. Like we did 12th Night all female, and we did Antigone all female. So we're really exploring this female power.
Yeah, there's a message in all this, isn't there?
yeah.
A not too veiled message.
Well,
right?
This is our first all female musical. Normally we do import in males, but this time I knew that the students were up for grabbing these male roles, and we had to change the vocal range a little bit. We had
sure.
to change the keys for the songs, but
sure.
it still works. Yeah, well, works well.
So the girls are embracing the male roles.
Definitely. They're not afraid to wear mustaches and paint on goatees and to find a different masculine way to walk.
Like, yeah, but you got to change your whole body language,
exactly,
don't you?
Exactly. Our little Sultan is played by a seventh grader, Gemma, and we have her in a little fat suit and the way she waddles and it's pretty adorable.
I bet.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a lot of fun with these productions.
We do. And this production has been really fun because we've brought in a juggling extraordinaire to teach us how to juggle. So all of the cast learn to juggle. And you see at least five of them juggle throughout the show.
That's amazing. I mean, it's amazing to me that anyone can learn to juggle, frankly.
Yeah.
You learned a little yourself, didn't
you?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I can do the scarves. I'm not so good at the balls, but...
And you recommend scarves for the novice
scarves
juggler.
Are the place to start because gravity is a little bit easier. They fall slower, but the balls just drop.
And the idea is, how long did it take the kids to learn this?
We had a two-hour workshop, but then they went home and practiced, right? You have to keep practicing. So they learned the basics in the workshop. Yeah.
Basics, which are what? Throw everything up to the same height and keep
yeah.
a steady rhythm with
mm-hmm.
your hands and
exactly.
everything.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And in the production, the juggling kind of what? Illustrates the action or?
Well, it's there are like parades and like magic that happens.
Uh-huh.
We have like Prince Ali, boom, 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 you know, the Prince Ali song.
Right.
And then the Friend Like Me. So there's juggling and there's, we have fans with long flowy scarves attached. And we've got like ribbon dancer things that the kids do.
Uh-huh.
In it. Mm-hmm.
Where do the puppets come in?
Oh, so Iago is a puppet. We have this really cool, beautiful red parrot puppet. And one of the students has gotten to, she takes the puppet home and does the mouth opening in the mirror to figure out when she should be opening and closing it. And figuring out how to work with this puppet has been a really fun adventure for us. Always trying to find new things to try and learn in the show.
We're seeing a lot more puppetry in theater, aren't we?
Puppets are so neat. I mean, they're just... They can do so much that humans can't do. And to put it in a little body, you know, like in a non-human body is really neat. Like the bird can fly, you know, and a human person couldn't fly and you couldn't get that same image as the little bird.
Who's Iago? What character is that?
Iago is Jafar, our evil villain.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right-hand parrot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's kind of a sarcastic, kind of caustic character. But he loves Aladdin. This little parrot is on Aladdin's side.
So there's kind of the overall message is kind of a believe in yourself message is what it sounds like.
Yeah. We explore the theme of freedom. What is freedom, right? Because Genie really wants freedom and doesn't want to have to report to somebody else.
Doesn't want to go back in the lamp, right?
Yeah. And then also, you know, how can we be ourselves and be true to ourselves and make choices that, you know, show who we are instead of trying to be like this prince or a sultan and Jafar wishes to be a genie at the end. And then that's his demise, right? He wants to be something else.
It sounds as if part of what you do, Claire, is sort of look at the kind of lessons that girls of school age need to learn or, you know, that are beneficial to them.
Exactly. And trying to find ways to make it applicable to the students in their lives because they spend every day after school, you know, 2 hours a day working on it. So yeah. I want it to be meaningful to them, and I want them to really have, you know, like power in their performances. And in order to do that, they need to have their heart and their identity somehow interwoven with the story.
Sounds as if that's exactly what's going to happen,
Claire. Yeah, I think so.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Well, pleasure
to talk
to you.
I hope you all can join us.
Yeah. Director Claire Fallon is presently in rehearsal staging an all-girl production of Aladdin Jr. that will run at Tenney Theater on the grounds of the Priory in downtown Honolulu the weekend of April 21st.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, presenting Ocean Dreams. Vocalist Aaron Mahi performs in a world premiere, Kumalipo Reflections, Saturday night and Sunday afternoon at the Blaisdell, hisymphony.org.
There are always a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama, is somehow able to keep track of them, which is a good thing because he keeps us mindful of events going on in our community that are going on under the radar. And today, Honoka'a is a small town, and it's kind of, you know, off there on Hawaii Island, but they're pretty cosmopolitan small town, isn't it?
Yes, they are. I've been there.
Yeah.
And I've been to the People's Theater, and tomorrow they will be hosting a group from the Bay Area. The group is called Baraka Moon, and they bring together influences from mystical Sufi trance songs, Indian ragas, African percussion, and the Australian Aboriginal didgeridoo. All of that, Chris.
Where else would you find that in Honoka'a? It's probably the only performance of its kind in Honoka'a.
Yes.
That night.
Tomorrow, yes. Baraka Moon delivers soulful and spiritually charged dance music with a positive message of inclusiveness and peace for the whole world. Showtime is 7 p.m. at the People's Theater in Honoka'a. Tickets are available at the door.
That's good fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then also on Hawaii Island, there's a group dedicated to a certain type of eucalyptus tree. That's kind of intriguing.
Yes. Kelly Dunn of the Painted Trees of Hawaii Foundation will present a one-hour program about the natural beauty and preservation of the Eucalyptus deglupta, or the rainbow eucalyptus tree. And you can go to their website, the Painted Trees of Hawaii Foundation, and see this tree. It's very beautiful. And Kelly will also display his collection of photo art images. This program is at 5:15 p.m. in the Kealakekua, a public library, and it's free.
And you know, Derek, they've got one at Foster Gardens here in town. I just happened to see it a couple weeks
ago. Oh, no kidding.
It doesn't look quite real.
Oh.
It really looks as if somebody painted a tree.
Really?
Yeah, they're gorgeous.
Ah.
And Oto-san's son is himself a ukulele virtuoso. Yeah.
Yes, of course. Ukulele artist Herb Oda Jr. plays tomorrow at the Napilikai Beach Resort on Maui. It's part of the Masters of Hawaiian Slack Key Guitar series, but every once in a while they let someone who plays the ukulele come and do a concert. Admission will be charged. All show tickets are open seating and doors open at 6:45 and the show begins at 7:30.
Sounds good, Derek. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at under-the-radar events, and you can find out more about them at hawaiipublicradio.org.
And that's going to do it for us for today, but we'll be back with you tomorrow. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the University of Wisconsin's Population Health Institute will release their annual rankings of health of nearly every county in the country, including the four in Hawaii. We'll hear more then.
And the Hawaii Potters Guild is celebrating 50 years with a community outreach program.
If you've got something to say to us, call our talkback line, 808-792-8217.
And you can find HPR in the Apple App Store, our new app on Google Play. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow right back here for more of The Conversation.